and welcome to Parenting Help with Vigeo Behavior Consulting. Join us for conversations with experts in the fields of cognitive behavior, mental health, behavior analysis, education, and child psychology. On this podcast, we examine the challenges that parents are facing and share insights and strategies that have helped other parents with similar issues. I'm your host, Katie Palmer. I'm a parenting coach and board-certified behavior analyst. I'm also the owner of Vigeo Behavior Consulting. I am fortunate to be able to engage in conversations with some incredible professionals whose depth and breadth of experience can offer guidance for parents who are looking for new ideas. I hope you find this podcast useful, engaging, and insightful. Today, I am honored and excited to have the opportunity to talk once again with Dr. Sarah Cassidy. And today, we also have Dr. Lisa Coyne with her. These two are wonderful women who I'm so proud to know and learn from every time I interact with them or interact with any of their materials. And today, we will be talking about some of their collaborations across the pond, if you will. And also about their book series. And we talked briefly with Dr. Cassidy last time about Tired of Anxiety for Kids. And the next episode of the series coming out, or the next book, is Tired of Anxiety for Teens. And I know many of the parents in my audience will be very excited to pick that up. So if you could each do a little brief introduction, and I'd love to hear more about how the two of you met and began your collaboration.
You want to go first?
Sure. Well, I think Katie's audience have already met me, but I'll briefly introduce myself. I am Sarah Cassidy. I am an educational child and adolescent psychologist, and I'm also a peer-reviewed ACT trainer, and I'm the director of the Smithsfield Clinic at BOI, and I'm also with Lisa, the co-director of the New England Center for OCD and Anxiety here in Athboy, County Meath. It's the Irish branch of Lisa's clinic in Boston. And over to you, Lisa.
So I'm Dr. Lisa Coyne. I am, So I'm a researcher, clinician, and I'm a clinic director now. And as Sarah mentioned, I run the New England Center for OCD and Anxiety in Boston. And we also have branches in LA and New York, and we are hoping to expand nationally in the US and internationally here in Ireland as well. And I've worn a lot of different hats. I've been a professor. I've been a researcher doing work primarily with parents and parenting, and now clinic director. And I really, really am very lucky and feel so blessed to be able to do what I do.
And the two of you have begun this collaboration fairly recently. Is that accurate?
That's correct. We're about a year at NCOA, although we've been friends a lot longer than that.
You came over to Boston years ago.
I did. And actually, that's a few years ago now. That's probably 4 or 5 years ago now. Actually, Lisa, I don't know if Lisa has listened to, because I've given a few podcasts now about Tired of Anxiety Book One. I've also given a few trainings on the Magpies series, the children's mental health series. And anytime anybody asks me how I met Lisa Coyne, I always say that I stalked her. I actually don't know if Lisa knows that I frequently publicly speak of my stalking of Lisa Coyne or my fangirling of her rock star
status. Oh, please.
So I had been working a lot and continue to work a lot. I mean, one of our key, my career started out as an educational psychologist and working a lot in the assessment and treatment of children with learning difficulties, emotional behavioral difficulties, but primarily I was doing assessment in the school system, and I lecture a lot on child development and neurodevelopmental differences. So I was always doing a lot of assessment. And, you know, a lot of the kids I was working with, you know, whether they had kind of clinical anxiety disorders or just a lot of anxiety as a result of the other things they were dealing with, What I found is when I was treating anxiety, I just really found we weren't really getting like a proper handle on it. And so I was sending kids here in Ireland. I found I was sending kids to our, you know, kind of specialist services here in Ireland, or I was working with them here in clinic for brief periods of time. And I felt I was doing my best work, you know, and I had done a lot of study. I'm like a, you know, card carrying, proud, dyed in the wool nerd. And I really felt I was doing my best. And, you know, if I couldn't get a good handle on it, I was reading a few books, I was ringing a few nerd friends, and I wasn't really getting as far as I thought I could be getting with these kids. And I was sending to them to our child and adolescent mental health teams. And then a lot of these kids were kind of coming back around to me, still not, you know, having had their anxiety, I felt, successfully treated. And then I heard Lisa Coyne delivering a training. I would have known Lisa's name through the ACBS circles, but Lisa gave a training on child and adolescent anxiety at one of Aisling Curtin's courses. And just after hearing Lisa speak, it was just like, you know, like a penny dropped or like a light bulb moment. And I just thought, oh, that's it. Like, this is how it's done. And so that, I think, was the moment I started stalking Lisa Coyne. And and Lisa is very, very generous with her time and her knowledge. And she said, oh, you know, you should come out and visit me.
She did.
And I did. And I follow her around McLean and, you know, sit in on all her sessions and stay in her house and, you know, really, really, you know,
blast,
pick her brains.
Really.
Yeah, well, we had a great time. Yeah. No, I think we're kind of similar creatures
we
and
are
similar mindsets. Yeah.
So. Sarah, can I ask a question about that light bulb moment that you described? Do you recall what the difference was that you were hearing when Lisa spoke that was like, oh, this is the piece I'm missing, or this is the place I haven't gone yet that could make the difference?
Lisa still talks about, I feel like I'm talking about Lisa like she's not in the room, even though she's
right beside me. I'm feeling a little uncomfortable about all of this right now. That's
Lisa,
okay.
I want you to lean into this discomfort. Exposure, Lisa.
Yes.
This is an intervention.
You're being stalked.
So there was something, I think, there's something about, you know, playing the long game. There's something, yeah, and it's not just about feel the fear and do it anyway. You know, it's about, like, you know, what are you doing this for? Why are you doing this? You know, it's about the values. It's not about, like, you know, I think we can get any kid in the school gates for one day of school. That's not why we're doing it. And I think, you know, every parent knows that. And I think, like, to a certain extent, we've all had those moments, like as parents or as educators or as friends, where, like, you can see somebody in a really difficult moment and you just do the thing, you know, you just, you know, eat the vegetable or, you know, like, take your driving test, you know.
I know this will help. I know this will help. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the answer. Just do it. But it's like, how do we, you know, get somebody to step over that threshold without just shoving them, you know, without just throwing them in at the deep end? And, like, what's the difference between shoving them in and getting them to choose it? And like, there was some way that, like,
very important.
Yeah, where it seemed like Lisa was helping them to choose it, but, like, allowing them to open their eyes. And, like, it was like somehow she was getting them to see it. And, like, it was somehow in the way that Lisa has this magic way of describing it to them, where it's like, you know, let me help you open your eyes. I'm not going to force you to do it, but I'm right here beside you. Mm-hmm. And let me help you open your eyes. And I don't know what it is exactly, that she said. Like, if you ask me to repeat her exact words, it's almost like it was a feel. I'm sorry, I'm a scientist. It was a feel. I promise you I'm a scientist, but it was a feel in the way that she described how she worked with, you know, children and young people and their parents. And I thought, you know, that's the thing that we're not doing. And like, you know, I've just heard a masterclass and I need to like dive into this and figure out, you know, how do I do that so I can bring that to my young people too.
I recognize what you're saying so deeply. It has been also my experience with Lisa. And so I want to offer you the opportunity, Lisa, to address this, because we're just having a conversation about you with you in the room.
Yeah, Lisa's also here for you. Yeah.
Based on, like, now you've heard sort of two of us like recounting a little bit about our experience in hearing you describe how you work.
Yeah. So I think for me, I learned the most. I mean, I trained at Brown University with really incredible mentors, with Henrietta Leonard, who has since passed away. She's one of the, she used to work with Sue Suido in NIH on PANS and PANDAS, if any of your audience are familiar with that. She was my postdoc mentor, and then the amazing Jennifer Freeman and Abby Garcia, and I learned so, so much from them in their clinic about family-based work with OCD. And we specifically back then worked on a clinical trial called POTS Junior, which is the pediatric OCD treatment study for children who were aged 4 to 9. And it's an incredibly well-designed study. Their manual is absolutely beautiful. And I learned so much, but it was interesting because I, like Sarah, I'm also an ACT trainer, and you know, we infused a lot of these pieces into the work with parents of these young children about how to model, how to handle your own anxiety as a parent, right? How to treat it with acceptance, how to change your relationship to it so that it's not something that you treat as toxic, dangerous, and bad that needs to be mitigated, but it's just it's an experience that you have that can give you some information and you might not like it, but it can also help you move out of danger. Everybody has anxiety. And sometimes when you're overwhelmed by that anxiety and it leads you to avoid, it's how do you change your relationship to that where you can instead move towards those things that you care about, right? And so that, it's funny because I did tons of parenting research. I was a tenured professor at Suffolk University for years. And actually, like you, I did assessment too. I taught assessment for 9 years there. And I did a lot of work with young kids, did a lot of research on parenting. But then I went to McLean to found the OCD Junior, which is the OCD Institute, right, for children and teens. And I learned so much from the kids and teens that went through those doors, because it was sort of a bimodal population. You had, on one hand, kids that got really ill and really stuck in anxiety and OCD, really like homebound kids that couldn't go to school, wouldn't do anything, simply because they did not have access to care where they lived. They did not have access to people who were well-trained in exposure-based treatment for anxiety. But then we also had the kids who you might define as treatment refractory. They had done ERP, which is exposure and response prevention. They had done, you know, all of this work, and they weren't benefiting from it. And, you know, the clinical data, you know, the research data tells us that actually it's not great for kids with anxiety. So one piece of data is that, you know, there's a significant proportion, 20 to sometimes 40% of kids that don't benefit from ERP. And if this is our gold standard, that's a lot. I'm not satisfied with that either as a clinician or as a researcher.
Yeah.
But the other piece is in the single best longitudinal trial we have on child and adolescent anxiety, 48% of kids successfully treated relapse. That's 1 in 2. So to me, this speaks to kind of Sarah's piece about like it's not enough to just get them to face their fears and push them off the diving board and put them in the situation or ask them to do it, right? You have to work harder than that, and we have to strive for more, right? How do we, for their lifetime, shape a different relationship to their anxiety? And how do we help them see and get that doing that is a vital and expansive thing that can give them back their freedom, their agency, and, you know, they can even expand that repertoire into other areas of their life that aren't related to their OCD or their anxiety or whatever. And so I learned a lot from those kids. And one of the things I learned is that a lot of these kids felt coerced. They felt like they were told what to do. They did it, but the whole time it was a control strategy. They would do it so that they weren't anxious. So you have that, I'll do the thing. I'll face the anxiety so that I'm not anxious. Am I not anxious? Crap, I'm still anxious.
And looking at that, looking at those symptoms as, or the anxiety, right, the thing, as something to get rid of instead of, you know, accepting like this part of who I am, and how do I use this and move through it, and how do I settle it down to move right. forward?
Yeah, exactly.
It's so that's that mindset, that, right?
Yeah.
And framing, it's a framing of what some people think of as a disorder or a problem, as this is a part of who I am that I need to navigate.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the issue is not the anxiety at all. Mm-mm. It's the persistent avoidance response when yes. anxiety shows up. Right.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I like to, one of the things that's important to me as a human, like, and as a clinician, right, is to always kind of like focus on life experiences that I might have that can give me information, they can give me a little bit of color in how I describe things, give me a little bit of insight. And so I have a fear of heights, and I, you know, just went to Iceland with my son who's 18, and that fear of heights showed up, and it was horrible because I watched him and his sister, like, and they're like mountain goats. So they're like, oh, look, a dangerous edge. Let me sit on the edge and dangle it, like my feet over the edge.
Mom, take it.
Like, don't say. So I did a good job not, like, you know, I was internally freaking out, and I did a good job of not saying anything. But then when it came my turn to like walk on edges, I was like, just get me off the freaking mountain. and right. I know how to do this, right? And yet here I am, humbled again
yeah.
by this fear. And I realized I was just so primed by that. It was such a big thing. And I thought, okay, so tomorrow, what we're going to do is we're going to go back up the mountain, and we're actually going to do this the right way. And so I was back in the saddle, and I was like, I'm scared, and I want to be here. I am choosing this. I'm going to look over the edge. I'm going to go slow, and all the things. And it completely transformed the experience, you know, right. once again, you know. So, but I think the point here is anxiety is not ever going to go away forever. It's going to show up. And so it's always there with a question. Are you going to keep doing this thing that's going to make your life the one that you want to live? Or are you going to avoid it? Right. And so helping kids see that as that, that's just life. That doesn't mean you're flawed and that you have a disorder or problem. Right. And yes, they might have significant functional impairment. And, you know, I don't want to get in a big thing about diagnoses. I do believe they're important, you know, and useful in communicating. However, it doesn't mean that these kids don't have everything that they need to live lives that matter to them, that are fantastic.
Yeah, that idea of seeing what's important and what life do I want to have. I have a question for you both about creating a space where a child or a teen can have that imagination if they have so for so long been hiding or pushing things away or trying to keep anxiety away. Do you have any ideas about sort of unlocking that I could climb that mountain. I want to spend time with my friends who do this thing that's scary for me.
Yeah. You want to go, Sarah?
Well, I actually want to add something. I really like what Lisa said about being humbled by fear. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I always liked, and I think this is what Lisa set up in McLean, and I think that was really special and really unique. And I you know, think it was really important that that was set up at McLean, which I think was the first inpatient pediatric OCD center.
The second residential program in the country, I think.
In the world?
I don't know.
Okay.
They're rare anyway.
Yeah.
But it was the first child and adolescent one at McLean, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what Lisa said about being humbled by fear, you know, that really stood out for me, you know, as you said it, but it also struck me when I visited you in Boston that first time. And, you know, one of the things that Lisa has always done in the way she works with children, adolescents, and families who are experiencing anxiety is this embodiment of meeting them where they are at. And the first day that I visited Lisa there in Boston, and there was a young person that was supposed to be starting the program that day, and they were that crippled by their anxiety and their OCD that even though they were enrolled to start at, let's say, 9 a.m. and start that day, and they had flown from, I think, somewhere in Canada or wherever, but they were at their hotel and they actually couldn't leave the bathroom. And so
I remember this.
Lisa and I hopped in Lisa's car and, you know, talk about meeting them where they are at. We actually drove to, am I okay to say this? Sorry.
You just can't say who. Yeah, yeah. You can.
So we actually drove to the child's hotel room and Lisa stood outside the child's hotel room and spoke to the child through the door of the room and, you know, like told the kid, like, I'm here. I know you're scared, you know, when you're ready, like, I know this must be terrifying and I'm here and here are the things that we can do and here are the ways that we might work and, you know, like said all the things that a person who is terrified might need to hear about, you know, like signaling safety and signaling that, you know, these are the things that we might do together if you choose to work with me. So I just thought, I mean, these are none of the things that we are doing anywhere else in the world. And here's Lisa Coyne in her car, driving out to meet this kid exactly where she's at.
Yeah.
And like thinking about other things, you know, like these sort of like additional scaffolds that probably don't exist, like things we need are like, you know, parental buy-in, you know, you've also got parents that are terrified and like trying to get the kid to do what the kid needs to do. Because of course the parent knows like my child's life is getting smaller and smaller and smaller and I don't know what to do here. And what Lisa did in that moment was she gave the mother a hug, like, and told her that she was doing an amazing job. And I thought, oh my God, like what a perfect thing to do for like a mother that had absolutely no idea what to do and told her she was doing an amazing job. And I thought, oh my God, like this
there's
is
so just... much, there's so much compassion for the parent in that moment who doesn't know what to do and wants to follow through and wants to be the good parent. But there's also just a willingness to not try to reassure the child. You're okay. It's all okay. It's going to be like, it was much more about here's what it might look like and just sharing more information and that signaling of safety rather than listen to me, I'm telling you, you're okay. Yeah. When they don't feel okay.
Yeah. But, so and I think I'll let you take from there, but I just wanted to say like, kind of like meeting a child where they're at, you know, letting them know, you know, here are the ways that we might work, but you know, like being willing to be humbled by fear and acknowledging this is really hard. Like, you know, what you're experiencing is normal. You know, it's very common. The rates of anxiety are enormously high. And for some people, you know, this doesn't mean that you are broken, but the experience of anxiety can be absolutely crippling. And for some people, when you feel anxiety, and you know, we talk about like the physiological responses to anxiety, it's enormous. And the way people feel it can be, you know, this, you know, horrendous pain in your stomach or like this like heart wrenching. Absolutely. So you're not imagining that. Like if you or your child are experiencing those feelings, you are not imagining them. They can be intense and crippling.
And I want to say too that, like, you know, we're very lucky. There are lots of people that do
work like that.
Yeah. But I don't think that there are many in Ireland at all. Right. And that's the difference, right? We're lucky. There's more providers of this kind of treatment in the US, but there's not a lot in Ireland. And I think one of the things that Sarah is describing that's really important, I'm just thinking like, there's a couple of pieces here. So one of the things that's become really important to me is the training of how to treat this, to really get clinicians well trained in not just the technical aspects of how do you do an exposure and build an exposure hierarchy and how do you teach ACT, you know, and how do you do all of the elements of ACT, but like, what's your therapeutic stance? Like, what are the really core ingredients? And one of them is, the first thing is you have to understand that all behavior makes sense. So, and in order to really get that piece, right? Like, why is this kid in the bathroom and why won't they come out? And what's happening for this poor parent who's like trying their hardest to do everything, is you have to put yourself in their shoes, right? Not just cognitively, but emotionally, right? You have to let in how big this is, because if you don't, they will feel invalidated and they will not feel seen, right? And one of the things that, and again, another hiking metaphor, when I was hiking around like on these ledges, right, I'm perfectly capable of doing these things, and I'm much more willing to do these things if I trust my guide, right? So there's a piece about the safety piece, right? Not reassurance, but that you can trust this process. You can trust that if you do this evidence-based work, you will see changes. You can trust that if you try something that seems impossible, like, oh my goodness, increasing your willingness to experience and explore and be curious about your anxiety, and you take it with you as you engage in these other things in your life, something's gonna happen, right? Something different that you have no idea is gonna happen, right? And so I think one of the most important things, like, that I try and do with both parents and kids when I meet them, is to, I want them to feel what's possible, that there is possibility, because previously, they're like, this is, you know, they don't see it, they can't get there, they're too focused on the anxiety, you know. So yeah, I would say
that's possible.
Yeah
I think that's sometimes where my use of the phrase, wouldn't it be wonderful if you were wrong, comes in.
Yeah, I love that. That's great.
And usually in the context of, you know, you've had a lot of experiences that lead you to predict what's going to happen in the scenario you're describing. And wouldn't it be wonderful if you were wrong? What would it take for you to be wrong? You know, and that imagine, going back to that idea of like engaging with that imagination to open the possibility.
Yeah, exactly. And starting to tell yourself a different story.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that happens with kids who are really stuck is they'll tell themselves a story about like, this bad thing's going to happen. I know it's going to be awful. It's going to be up. See, it's awful. See, it's awful. Is it awful? See, it's awful. And that's all they're really noticing. And so one of the things that we do from an ACT perspective, I think, is to disrupt that process, right? And just have them either notice with their five senses, be curious. That's a different behavior, right? And imagine something different. And really what we're doing, and this is really important, I want to say this, like when I learned how to do exposure-based work, it was always like, you know, this sort of habituation model where the focus was the anxiety. We're going to feel the anxiety. We're going to put you in a situation where it's going to get really high, and then you're going to stay there, and then you have to stay until it kind of like declines, and then you do this over and over and over, and then you realize, oh my gosh, you know, I'm not anxious, or this doesn't make me anxious anymore. And that's great. And we like that. I don't like to feel anxious when I'm on cliff edges. It's really inconvenient, actually. But but actually, I think it's more effective and accurate to think about what's happening during like exposure-based treatment as, in the presence of this thing that you are frightened of, whatever it is, we're going to shape a different and more varied repertoire of behavior rather than just avoidance, right? Yeah. That gives treatment teeth, and that gives clinicians something to do. Because one of the very basic things I learned when I was like a first year doctoral student from my super, super behavior analytic mentor, Alan Gross, who I adore, right, was it's so much easier to teach people what to do than to get them to stop doing something, right? So yeah. It's just very simple, but it's really important, right? What could you do differently?
Yeah, learning is easier than unlearning.
Absolutely, and there is really no unlearning, right? There's learning new things.
So if you were going to instruct a parent how to guide their child, their teenager, let's say, through this, in the presence of what I'm frightened of, I'm going to change how I relate to it, how I talk about it, how I think about it, and how would what can a parent do in that situation if they hear you and go, oh, that's it, that's what I want to do with my child?
Can you say something about this first before we answer that question?
Yeah,
there is not a lot out there for parents of teens with anxiety. There's a lot of work on parents of younger children, parents of school-age children. Now there's even a little bit of work being done with kids who are failure to launch, right? Kids who are older. But there's really not a ton for parents of teenagers. And they're, you know, it's kind of, there more approaches are being developed. So there's the SPACE program from Ellie Leibovitz, which kind of takes all comers. But stuff that's very specific, right, to parents of teens when your teen is like changing and they don't really listen to you the way that they used to.
I'm familiar with this.
I know, me too. Well, mine are like, right? But like, it's this pivotal point, right, where parenting shifts from your directive and you have a little bit more influence to actually you don't, right? And actually, how do we do this?
And
how do
and teaching is going to backfire.
So one of the things that was really important is kids still, even if they're teenagers, look, they need you. They do need their parents. And you know how parents, you know, handle or treat their own stress, anxiety, nerves, whatever you want to call it, and how the kids learn from watching that, right? The other thing is, one of the things that we know happens in families of anxious teens and kids is parents accommodate, right? Because who wants to see their kids anxious? If I can fix that, I'm gonna fix it, right? But sometimes that fixing goes overboard, and what it does is it steals opportunities away from the kids to learn A, that they actually can do it, and B, it sort of reinforces the notion that anxiety is something to be gotten rid of, right? And so addressing those kinds of issues. So the very first thing that I do is like, I wanna know what the parents are doing with their own anxiety, right? I wanna know how they handle it, what do they talk about it? How do they, like, what are the really subtle things that they do? Do they fix a lot of stuff for their kids? Are there things that they don't do because their child is anxious and they don't want to trigger them? Have they changed their whole family focus? Like, do they, if they have a child who's scared of roller coasters, do they never go to theme parks? You know, or do they never go outside if there are spiders in the lawn? You know, so thinking about both personal things, like how parents talk about and model for their kids handling emotions, but also how it has changed the structure and the functioning of the family, the system of the family, to kind of be anxiety focused and trying to keep it at bay. And yes. So it's one of the first things we need to start shifting.
I hear parents often reflect that everyone is walking on eggshells.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But then I would also add to that, be careful on your rules too, mm-hmm. because sometimes, like if you have created a rule, like if you've noticed that, okay, my child always avoids school on a Monday, and I know this is all anxiety based. Mm-hmm. So therefore, we are not going to give in to, you know, school avoidance on a Monday, because we know that that's not about a real physical illness. That's all about anxiety. Sometimes you can get so kind of wrapped up in, you know, being sure that you're not kind of feeding into this cycle of anxiety, that then when your child is actually sick, you're ignoring that, you know, so.
As it happens to be on a Monday.
because your child actually just happens to have gotten ill on a Monday. So, you know, I always try to think like, you know, notice, you know, try to stay sensitive to each moment and notice what's controlling my behavior as a parent. You know, am I being guided by my fear about being judged by the school system or the neighbors, or, you know, like, is this my fear driving this moment?
Am I ruining my child right now?
So like, notice.
By trying not to ruin my child. Yeah.
Yeah. So just try to be also driven by your values, you know, so like we want for, you know, we talk about your values being your compass and letting, you know, your child's values be their compass, but think about what's guiding your behavior in a moment as you help your child build their compass, if that makes sense, you know. Mm-hmm. So just because you've set up, you know, you don't have to have your child face their fear at every single moment. You know, sometimes your child might actually be sick. So don't get too rigid in your adherence to all the rules, because, you know, sometimes your child might actually be sick. And so try to be sensitive. And, you know, Lisa uses another nice phrase, like pause, notice, choose what's happening in this moment.
You know,
in this moment right now, you know, maybe this, you don't have to get on every roller coaster, you know, just notice what's happening in this moment and make a decision based on this moment.
And I love that concept. Yeah. Because does my rule apply here? Yeah. What am I seeing? What might be going on that's different? Because, you know, a behavior might look one way, a tantrum might be seeking attention in one situation, but avoidance in another. And that's just that present moment. Does the rule apply right now?
And think about it, right? So like, for a lot of parents, when their child is really spun out on anxiety, it feels like an emergency, right? An emergency, what people look for is, what are the three things I should always do? Like this is the rule thing that Sarah's talking about. Like, and so sometimes they'll come to treatment and be like, just tell me what to do when that happens. But, right? There are a couple of concepts: sensitive, responsive parenting, which are exactly what Sarah was talking about, right? That you can't it's not like putting together, like our colleague Evie Gold says this a lot, like it's not like putting together like an IKEA piece of furniture, right? It's the same every time. And so it's a very different way of parenting. It has to do with first helping parents notice, right, what's actually going on in the situation, right? And when they're spun out about their own, it's an emergency, I have to fix it. And then sort of feeling their way into what would be the most helpful thing to do in this moment, right? Do I gather more information? do I set up hard and fast, nope, we're going to school, because that sometimes is the appropriate thing and sometimes it's not. Mm-hmm. Right? It's more like a dance, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
I like you that. Know? Yeah.
It's more like a dance.
It's definitely a dance.
Right, yeah. Which is, you know, a little bit more work than here are the three things you do. Mm-hmm. Right.
Especially if you're dyspraxic like me.
Oh my goodness, right?
Super clumsy.
Yeah, I do find many parents want those instructions. Mm-hmm. What do I do when this happens? And when I don't give a clear answer on that, it takes us a while to sort of come around to the value of being in that present moment, the value of reevaluating the rules that we have, noticing the rules that we have in order to reevaluate them.
You know, I'm just thinking about one more piece. I think that's really important. Like, and I learned this, I feel like I'm always learning from life, like how to do these things. And like, I ride horses too. And I have this very sweet little Connemara pony mm-hmm. named, no kidding, Macaroni. And he often humbles me with like yeah. his the stable kids call him Spicy, but what that really means is he likes to buck people off, me most of all, right? And so it's humbling, right? Like to just and it's scary, and I also love riding and I love him, and I want to get better at this, and so I have to keep showing up and I have to keep being willing to feel stupid and to feel scared and feel like I look like an idiot and I'm the worst kid in class, which is a experience, right? For any of us.
Yeah.
And there's a piece here for parents that's really, really important. And that is that you have to also have a really heavy dose of self-compassion for not getting it right all the time. None of us. And we're Sarah and I are both parents, and mm-hmm. I'll speak for me. Mm-hmm. I almost, of course, have not gotten it right all the time. Mm. You know, right?
Yeah, I get it wrong a lot.
A lot
every
right?
day. Yes, every day.
Yeah. So if my children are listening, I do. I definitely acknowledge I am not getting it right all the time.
One of my favorite stories was when Josie, who's 23 now, was really little, and she's. A neurodiverse young fabulous person with ADHD, and she had a lot of anxiety herself, and she like, I forget what was going on, she might have been 8 or 9, and she walked in and she had this like little cup of, I don't even know what it was, had brown stuff in it, was some liquid, and I said, what is that, honey? And she said, it's potion to make you a better mom.
Yeah,
so there you go, parents, you're not gonna get it right.
Actually, I have another one. I have another one for you to add. During the pandemic, you know, Lisa, I teach parenting courses, and during the pandemic, when we were home, we were all homeschooling our kids here in Ireland. I know throughout the world, a lot of people are homeschooling, and I came in and I was trying to do some homeschooling. And I was completely losing my cool and doing an absolutely terrible job of it. And my now 12-year-old, I think he was 10 then, just looked at me and he was like, Mom, you should really consider taking a parenting course.
There you have it.
Thank you.
We're the experts, right? Oh my gosh. Yeah. So, and it's really important, I think, to both of us to say this to your listeners. Because I know, like, just putting myself in the shoes of parents who come, you know, I know they're feeling like, oh my God, they're going to tell me what I'm doing wrong. I know I'm doing it all wrong. This is awful. And it's so intimidating. And like, please, please, please know that, like, we like understand and have been there, you know, and that's a really important piece. And you got to let in, like, you got to be willing to do this sort of trial and error learning.
Yeah.
And we promise, like, your child will not break because you didn't get it right in that moment. It doesn't work like that. You'll feel like that, but making a space for, you know, if something doesn't go well, or you mess up, or you forget, or you, you know, you accommodate when you shouldn't, like, take it in, and learn from it.
Yeah.
And use that for next time. And that coming back to the table again, just keep showing up in your life, keep showing up, and stick close to the principles. That's where it's at, I think, for parents.
Right. Because we will always get another opportunity.
Yeah,
exactly. To try the things we're learning. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's a really good model too. Like, I think that's an important piece of modeling for your child.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, I didn't get this right. I'm sorry. I'm gonna show you again. I'm gonna say I'm sorry. I didn't get it right. Mm-hmm. Here's how I might do it next time. You know, I think that's
it's really important. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true acceptance too, and that's something that, like, I think often parents come in thinking that they have to be like perfect, and they don't.
I know.
They absolutely don't. And actually giving your child a gift to show them, how do you handle it when you are disappointed in yourself?
Yeah.
How do you handle it when you have made a mistake? I really wish that some of the young people that have, like, I've taught and that have come through the clinic doors had seen more of that and learned that and had good models for that. And so that's a big piece.
Yeah.
We have this amazing colleague, Darren Carnes, who's a clinician in Australia, in Perth, actually. And he's a really brilliant clinic director. And he talks a lot about how, you know, it's important for parents to be a good source of information. And what that means is that you keep the lines of communication going. And, like, whereas when you have younger kids, you might be able to be more directive. But when you have teens, you're more collaborative, and you're a good information source if you are accurate, if you can describe sort of like consequences for things that have happened or can happen, etc. And also, if you kind of are willing to, it's much less when you're parenting teens about you telling them what to do. It's much more like learning to sit beside them and look at whatever the problem is that they're struggling with together. And so one of the things I had to learn with Josie, who's my oldest, was when she'd come to me with a problem and ask for advice, instead of jumping into problem solving, I'd say, that sounds really hard. You know, how do you feel about that? What are you thinking might be a good thing to do about that? Right? And to ask good questions, to evoke, like, you've probably done some thinking about this. What are you thinking? You know, I like to feel like that. Are you stuck? Just, you know, what are some other ideas? You know, instead of telling them, right? And you're sort of, in doing that, it's a much more collaborative and gentle approach where they feel validated, right? You have empathized with them, and you have reinforced and noticed and elicited their own thoughts on this, like, your thoughts matter to me. What are you thinking? And that gives you an opportunity to shape, right? Based
and
on
teaching process too, rather than handing answers. Guiding teens through a process of their own problem solving. And if we are sitting with them in that process, and guiding, and, you know, one of my clients gave me the most wonderful metaphor as I was trying to describe the difference between when they're tiny and they cry, it's our job to fix, right? And as they get older, we still are fixers for a little while, but at some point in their growth, we actually have to hand that baton over. But it's not the same place for every kiddo. It's not the same place for each kid in the same family, and we don't know when it's going to be or how to do it until we're in it. And that's where that self-compassion piece, I think, comes in. We have to try.
Go.
Oh, well, I was going to say that parenting is a developmental task too.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Like, as our child grows, the way we parent them grows and changes. So like the information that we give them, so we're giving them lots of information, we're used to fixing and advising and jumping in, but how much we fix or advise or change or mold, we need to start gradually removing the scaffolding, because if we don't, then we're, like you said, robbing them of opportunities to be able to master those tasks Absolutely. Successively themselves.
100%.
And it would be totally inappropriate. Like, some of the things that we did in a very appropriate and supportive way for our child at two would be wildly inappropriate at four, you know, and I mean, grossly inappropriate, you know, at 10. And then if we think about, like, you know, the things, like, you know, my eldest is now 22 and in San Diego, and like, it's killing me, you know, that I don't have this information about what he's doing in a day-to-day way. And, you know, like, I want to know all the things and I'm not knowing any of them. It's absolutely killing me. Yeah. But, you know, but that's also entirely developmentally appropriate for him to not be giving me all the details of his life. And I'm just hoping that he'll, you know, reach out and tell me as and when he needs me. But it's really difficult. It's really difficult to let go of that stuff. Yeah. But there was one other thing I wanted to touch back on, Lisa, when you mentioned Darren Cairns and, like, you know, how much we advise or how much we support and the way in which we do it. And I remember Darren Cairns saying something I thought was just absolutely profound. And he said, you know, you can't grow a tree if you
say this.
I love this.
It's me too.
You can't grow a tree if you keep chopping it down.
That's right.
And I just think, like, you know, the way that we speak to our child or the way that we shape a child. And, you know, I can, you know, and I don't know if this comes from sort of this, like, holy Catholic Ireland mentality where, you know, in my history, there's all these kind of the hand on the hip and the finger waggers, like, you should be, you know, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. And where we all thought, like, if you didn't shame your child into doing something, then you were doing it the wrong way. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we come from. And that's in, you know, if you grew up in Ireland, that's the way you taught your child to do the wrong thing or to do the right thing. You better be keeping up with the neighbors or you'd be the shame of the community. And of course, we now know that shame doesn't drive people, you know, it doesn't build kind of healthy psychological well-being. And so when I heard Darren Cairns say that, I thought, wow, that's, you know, that's not how we teach people to grow and thrive and flourish. You know, that's, we need to think in the language of gardening and, and growing and thriving. And we don't want to be chopping down our trees. You know, no. We want them to blossom and grow. And so, you know, I think developmental tasks work that way too.
Yeah.
And that reminds me of the article, I think, Lisa, you wrote with Darren.
There's a chapter, I think.
Could you speak a little bit about coercion? What I loved about that chapter was that it highlighted the subtleties that we may not recognize because they are so maybe cultural, or whether it's in our family or our heritage or our community.
Well, I mean, when you think about, I'm getting nerd out a little bit here. That's a big question.
I'm all for it.
When you think about human behavior change, right? When organisms are attending to things in their environment, they give far more allocation of their attention to the things that are threatening and dangerous and bad. And then they focus on getting rid of those things by avoiding or escaping, right? Mm-hmm. And so if you apply that to parenting and you think about, oh my gosh, my kid is doing this thing, it's really obnoxious, I have to stop that. I have to stop them from doing that. That's the chopping down, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of us approach parenting in our not so great moments in that way. Stop that whining, stop that avoiding. That's not scary, what are you doing? You know, etc. And it's much so shifting the focus to, as Sarah mentioned, like nurturing and growing. What do we want to grow in our child, right? Rather than what is the thing I have to fix in this child, right? And so coercion basically is a system, and it's something that we see in families, you know, ubiquitously, mm-hmm. like at different points.
And organizations.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's like, mm-hmm. stop that, or I'm going to give you something to cry about. Yeah. You know,
you're going to get fired.
You're going to get fired. Yeah. If you don't do that, that's going to happen. If you don't stop avoiding, if you don't need to eat those French fries, I'm going to put ketchup on them and make it worse, you know, or whatever. And so it's a lot of like getting people to do things by putting some aversive potential consequence, like a threat in front of them so that they do it. Right. I don't know about you, but that's not a great, it doesn't feel great when you have.
It doesn't usually work on me. I tend to go absolutely opposite direction.
Well, and that is exactly right, because the research that that grew from was on families of oppositional children. It was this brilliant and beautiful work by a psychologist, Jerry Patterson, years and years ago in the early 80s. And we see this in families with anxiety too, right? Mm-hmm. And we see this in all different ways, right? So on the kids part, sometimes when kids are super, super anxious, and parents are like, no, but you have to do the thing. You have to go to the store, you have to go to school. They will escalate their behavior and make it aversive so that the parents stop, right? And on the parents and unfortunately, sometimes clinicians' side, it can feel coercive also. Like you have to do this or you're not gonna get better. And it can be very subtle. It can be very coercive or very subtle, like just do this, you're gonna be anxious forever or whatever, in the way we talk about things. And so, and like you, Katie, like I go the opposite direction and a lot of these kids do too. And so the harder work then is, how do we shape willingness in kids and teens to experience their own anxiety, right? Yeah. Now, in families, one of the things that we do is there are beautiful caregiver-only approaches that you can use, right? Like the SPACE program that we've mentioned before. We like talking about Ellie Leibovitz's work, and this is really cool stuff. It's stuff that we've known for a lot of years, but what's unique about his research is that he found in studying this approach that just working with parents alone and not working with kids, right, directly led to significant changes in their avoidance behaviors, which is really awesome. Mm-hmm. And so what you teach parents to do is look at their own behavior, where they might be backing off when a child is coercive and say, actually, no, we're going to still do it, or changing a part of the way the family system functions so that it's harder for kids to avoid. And it's, you're not going to directly do anything with the child, which is, it's a little bit like parents are like, what do you mean? This is just about me. And so there's a little bit of stuff that we need to, you know, help them understand there. It's like, you're changing a system. Mm-hmm. You guys are in a system. And if you change one element of the system, the whole system changes.
You change the context around the child, which allows opportunities for them to change their behavior. It's this, you've just justified my entire model of parent coaching, by the way. as well as like, that's how we founded Two Roads Academy, was on based on this idea that when we get the adults to engage, and we use ACT as part of our model, when we get the adults to change the context to adjust the contingencies around the typical behaviors of kiddos who were struggling, it really gave them opportunities to consider different ways of getting their needs met and even understanding what their needs were. We have great, hilarious stories about conversations we used to have with some of these kids. And when they would start to understand what was going on, they would just look at us and laugh and go, oh. And it's because we responded in a way that was not what they were used to, but they were starting to become a little bit amused by, oh, this isn't going to work for me anymore.
Right. And I think those, you know, ACT is essential to any parenting approach, because parents are often, like, if parents are not aware of how they're handling their own emotions and thoughts, they're probably getting pushed around by them, right? Mm-hmm. And so even though they might know, oh, I should be blah, blah, blah in this situation, they're going to get derailed by a strong emotion. And so helping them have those skills that we know are so important in psychological flexibility really is something that can make their responses to things like space more robust, or behavioral parent training, or, you know, family-based exposure treatment, you know, all of those things.
Did we shift gears and talk more specifically about your book?
Yes. I mean, I think
a lot of this is in it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Or talk about maybe the whole series.
It is
so much, and I'm just gonna shout out and promote this every way I can, because these books are so accessible, they're so readable and helpful. Okay, now I'll stop talking and let you talk.
No, well, we appreciate that.
No, we
appreciate
that.
And I suppose one of the reasons why we wrote the books was that, you know, not every kid can make it to clinic. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have long waiting lists, you know, not every kid has the money to access private therapy.
Correct.
And even if they do have the money to access private therapy, there's long waiting lists. And, you know, I think in a lot of contexts, you know, attending therapy has been pathologized. But, you know, hopefully, you know, most kids can read a book, or can read a book with the assistance of a parent, or maybe a teacher, or, you know, an auntie, or some other person in the background. And so basically, you know, book one that we talked about in the last podcast is session by session. Mm-hmm. If you were going to, you know, come to me or come to Lisa, it's session by session what we would do if you came to us with the experience of anxiety. That's what you'd get session by session. If you were experiencing anxiety as a child, if you're experiencing anxiety as a teen, session by session, that's book two. And it's coming out in September.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're hoping to shape, you know, kind of mindfulness. We're hoping to think about things like control being a bad agenda. Mm-hmm. And we're hoping to think about things like, you know, let's look at avoidance. Is this actually working for you? You know, or, you know, might it be better? And we're looking at the way we look at the language too, you know, so we're trying to avoid ourselves, sorry to use the word avoid there. we're trying to avoid saying things like definitely do this and definitely don't do this. You know, we're instead using the language of exploration and
right.
curiosity,
discovery,
mm-hmm. exactly, you know, and using your values as your guide, mm-hmm. and more like, you know, letting go of the fight with your anxiety. And do you want to pick up from there?
I think one of the things that's fun about this whole series is that we both really wanted to write directly to the kids, you know, or their parents. And it's each chapter is a standalone thing. So like you can read it with your therapist, you can read it with your parents, you can read it on your own, you can do whatever you want with it. And it's all of the stuff in the books, right, has been vetted. Sarah's done a beautiful job running groups, running this stuff through little groups of kids who are anxious and teens. So we're getting feedback from them all along. Mm-hmm. We have a really wonderful, you know, young adult editor, copy editor, who's been assisting us with this book.
And the art as well, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And the artwork?
Yeah. Yeah. The artwork as well.
It's all developed by kids and teens, and we mm-hmm. have some stunning. One of the fun things we're going to do this week is actually go through all of the artwork. We have tons of it, and like kind of put it together with the written word. But mm-hmm. like to me, you know, just the tiniest proportion of kids with anxiety get any treatment at all, and mm-hmm. there's very few practitioners who are really trained. And so this is a really low cost, accessible resource. That was our goal, you know, like how do we get this more in the water? And it's, and I guess like when I think about it, it's like helping, like we're assuming that kids don't really, you know, the cultural messages they get about anxiety are that it's bad and that you need to get rid of it. So they're not really understanding how do brains work and how does anxiety work and why do you have it and like what could you do with it? And like, so it's giving them sort of this under the hood look at it, giving them the information that they need, and then encouraging them to engage in trial and error learning about it, and also to see what the cost of avoidance is, right? So we motivate in two ways. One is to help kids learn that control sucks. Frankly, you know, yeah. Like sometimes it's appropriate, but if you do it all the time, like it really doesn't work very well and your life gets really tiny. And what if there was a different way? That's one way of motivating. And the other way is to have them do exactly what you talked about earlier, Katie, like imagine what could be different. Yeah. Like in your life, if you didn't avoid everything, like what would that be like? Wouldn't that be amazing? What if it were possible? And start engaging them in, you know, taking small steps and broadening those behavioral repertoires that they show in the presence of anxiety. So we have the kid book, the teen book's coming out in September. We're very excited about that. And then we have three more.
Mm-hmm.
Three more.
There's a young adult book after that. And then there's a parent companion to the kid book and a parent companion to the teen book. Each book is essentially an exploration. So each chapter is kind of like, you know, like Lisa said, you know, it can stand alone, but it's kind of explore, think about these ideas. You can draw in the book, the art clubs, you know, we got feedback from the kids that attended the art clubs. They looked at the language, they drew the pictures, the artwork that you see in the book, you know, has all been done by the kids that attended our art clubs. The language has been vetted by the kids that attended art clubs too. It's really been kind of interactive, collaborative projects. This year, Lisa had an art club kind of collaboration with an artist.
A graphic designer named Sean Chinook, who is a person with lived experience of OCD. And he's a brilliant, brilliant designer. He has illustrated many books himself and he does amazing graphic art. And we got together with a high school in my town, and we invited whoever wanted to come and read the book and read the chapters and just draw whatever came to mind. And they gave us such beautiful, amazing work. And one of the things that was really interesting was the kids, when they came, were really anxious about doing this. They were very reluctant and afraid because they weren't sure their work would be perfect. Sean and I were there together, and we had the opportunity to talk with them and do a little bit of teaching on that's what the book is about. It's about learning. Like, if this is important to you and if you want to be able to do this, then like you could avoid it or you could take a risk and see what happens. And my goodness, they gave us such beautiful stuff. We're so proud of them.
See, Art Club itself is an exposure, and showing up every week is an exposure. Yep. And so we've found that too, like with our art clubs here. And, you know, we had we had JJ and Sarah, or two of our assistant psychologists here in the clinic. And we also had Dr. Roberta Hines guiding us here. She's an artist and one of our behavior analysts here in the clinic. Guiding us in the actual artwork, because I was there as a clinician, but I haven't got an artistic bone in my body. So that was a huge exposure for me trying to learn how to do art. But as we were going through, I think this is amazing every time we run an art club that, you know, some of our anxious kids, and they're giving us the feedback on the book and they're doing the artwork. But, you know, some of the kids are really showing up for it and like, you know, they're having enormous experience of anxiety, and some of them maybe haven't been to school all year, but they turn up to art club every single week in a school building, you know, and they're, you know, very much laying their experiences bare. They're talking to the other kids about their anxiety. And at the end of it, we always hold an art exhibit, and we put all of their artwork and all of the, you know, ways they drew their anxiety, all the ways they spoke about their anxiety. We put all of it up on display for, you know, them and all their other parents and anybody else who turns up to the exhibit. And we put it all up on the wall. I mean, it's such an enormous exposure. And this year, We're talking about also you having that those couple of exhibits in Boston.
Exactly, doing some exhibits at a local bookstore in Boston, having like a book opening and a reading and inviting the kids to come and putting their stuff up and framing it. Mm-hmm. So I think it'd be really fun. And I just want to hop on this for a second, because like one of the things that we know is that when kids are anxious, they feel alone, mm-hmm. especially when they're teenagers. It's so stigmatized. So this whole approach with this particular book, I think it's really important to us that we create a space where it's really normal and okay, and mm-hmm. in fact, really helpful to talk about your anxiety. And what they discover in art club and other, you know, these other sorts of groups that we run is that everybody's feeling the same way and nobody's talking about mm-hmm. it. Oh my gosh.
But our guys also amazing. Thought it was so cool that there was this whole other classroom somewhere in
across
Boston
the ocean, right?
doing the same thing that they were doing, and that our art was going to be put up at their exhibit.
Yes.
In the
so awesome.
Right? So yeah, very exciting, this international collab.
And like
as well.
What and to me, like this is one of my favorite things about this book series is like how cool is it that your anxiety, your experience of anxiety as a kid is turned into this opportunity where you get to contribute to a published work, right? Amazing. Like we're talking about transformation of function, right? Mm-hmm. Like, no, this is exactly your work. You're talking about it. You're drawing about it is going to help other kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's incredible. Across
it's
the
so
ocean.
More than a book, right? This is so much more than a book series. It is.
It's so fun doing it. Like
it goes in really so many dimensions and directions in how it can reach and support and it's breathtaking. I'm also noticing that we are running out of time. We had an extended period of time. I know. I could be really greedy and just keep you here. Thank you both so much, not just for this time today, but for all the work you're doing in all the ways you're doing it. I'm just not going to try to talk more. I'm often less speechless. So thank you both.
You too, Katie.
Thank you so much for having us. This is so fun.
Thanks for allowing us to talk about
these things we love, right?
Great conversations. And of course, you are both welcome anytime. Thank you both so much.
Thank you, Katie.
Bye, Katie. Thank you.
Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Please consider checking out the website www.vigiobx.com to find more helpful resources from our guests and from other professionals using acceptance and commitment training to support parents and children. You can leave comments or requests on the podcast page, find more information about our guests, and subscribe to our newsletter as well. We have a recommended book list, a blog, and options for a free 30-minute consultation if you're interested in working with us. Go gently and have a great day.